On today's episode of The Good Word, Ice Young joins us to discuss some of the more interesting parts of the NBA GM survey. Ice tells us who she's picking to win the WNBA Finals. And we talk about the Hall of Fame this weekend and maybe some guys who I have questions about going in. All that and much more coming up right now. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports and the host of this podcast. And we got some news, y'all. In addition to getting episodes of The Good Word on the Yahoo Sports NBA feed, you can also subscribe separately to this podcast, The Good Word with Goodwill, if having its own feed. A lot of y'all have come up to me in various spots and saying, "Hey, man, when are you going to get your own feed? Because I only want to listen to you." Well, that day is here for everybody who loves all the episodes of everything that Yahoo Sports NBA has to offer with some of our new guys and some of our existing guys. You can still get it there. Now, that means we're going to need a little bit more of your help to give us those five-star reviews and some of those suggestions in the comments on this podcast feed separately. Now, to the show. Today, we are joined by Ice Young. Of course, Ice is a former college basketball player at Syracuse. She's now a NBA and WNBA analyst for us here at Yahoo Sports. And of course, Ice is going to be here with us every Wednesday. Ice, we got a lot to get to, but how you doing?
I'm good. First, congratulations. Your own feed. That's exciting. We can tune directly into you.
You know what?
Look at you big time.
That just means that the smart people got smart. I had nothing to do with this, either one side or the other side. I'm not going to pretend that I'm smarter than anybody else. I thought it was a good idea when you had all the feeds under the BDL feed. And I also think that it is smart to have everyone else with its own feed in addition to having a Yahoo Sports feed. But enough of that clerical stuff, Ice. We're going to get into the outlet. We're going to hit on some of the news of the day. I was at a preseason game last night in Lansing where it was the Michigan State alumned Tom Gore's Detroit Pistons against the Michigan State alumned, what the heck is his name in Phoenix now? Why Matt Ishbia? Why did I forget Matt Ishbia's name? Ishbia played for Tom Izzo. And had a bunch of people there wearing purple. Ice, you know what I did yesterday? I showed up in a purple hoodie, not thinking anything of it. Like, I just needed a hoodie to grab, like, after the gym, and it was a Prince hoodie. You know, I'm a Prince fan, so I just grabbed the Prince hoodie with the 1999 lettering on it. And I show up, and all of a sudden, like, owners and people in the Pistons, you know, the executive team are texting me, "Oh, you're playing for the other team now?" I don't play for none of y'all. Let's get that straight. I play for me, okay? Let's get
Amen. Retweet.
Hey, Amen. Hey, we get that in. But I thought, Ice, we want to start with a little bit of the GM survey that came out yesterday. Of course, all 30 GMs were queried on a bunch of different questions by NBA.com. It's really a nice primer going into the season. An overwhelming amount of general managers selected the Boston Celtics to repeat as NBA champions. Ice, we haven't had a repeat champion since the Kevin Durant Golden State Warriors. And I say Kevin Durant Golden State Warriors because it was a different sort of years when Kevin Durant was roaming the earth over there. Nothing against Stephen Curry, but those were a different level of supernova type of teams. 83% of the GMs selected the Celtics. Are you surprised? Because I'm a little bit surprised given how long it's been since we had a repeat champion, but are you shocked that the Celtics are overwhelmingly the favorites?
I don't think I would say I'm shocked. I think with how they won the championship last year and who they have returning, the GMs are looking at rosters, they're looking at what exists, and I don't think it's surprising. 83% is pretty high. Like 70 maybe would have been probably what I would have expected. But I'm definitely not shocked. I feel like they are in the best position to repeat if there was going to be a team that's done that.
It's one of those weird things where they roll through the regular season, of course, with the 64 wins. They roll through the playoffs. They were pretty much untested the entire way, and yet and still we still have some questions. But because they are the champions, they're going to get that respect. Plus, y'all, they have this extra rocket fuel that they have in their back pocket, right? You have Jaylen Brown, who was not an Olympian, and it was a big stink about him not being an Olympian. Then you have Jason Tatum, who was an Olympian, and they were like, hey, we kind of have Kevin Durant and LeBron James, who might be two of the top 12 players of all time, who happen to play your position. You're just not going to play much here. And you could tell that it really affected him. Now, Ice, take me into the mind of someone like Jason Tatum here, because, of course, you are a former ball player.
Yeah.
Is that something that fuels a guy? Like, I think Jason Tatum versus the Golden State Warriors when he sees Steve Kerr, I think it's going to be some smoke in the city. I think he's going to try to get him a 50 ball. And I think that game is really, really early in the season in Boston, maybe like November 5th or 6th or something like that. I might try to be there. But is that a media creation, or do you think Jason Tatum really has this extra motivation?
Nah, I think you take that personally. I think as a hooper, anytime that you're on a team, put on a roster, even if it is the best in the world, you still take, you know, it personal when you don't play and when you don't get on the court. And again, this is a Jason Tatum that was coming off of winning a championship, right? And so it's like, you were on the best team. You're one of the best players. The other finals MVP and best player isn't here. You are here and you're not playing. Now, you mentioned, though, the players that he's sitting for, right? KD, LeBron. And then we saw the games in which KD and LeBron had to win games, right? And Steph, obviously. And so I think, yes, as a player, you take it personal. I think especially when you go up against Steve Kerr, no matter if you agree, disagree, you have all the respect in the world, I think you take it personal and you want to give them a 50 ball. But I also think, you know, you mentioned this to me when we were talking before this, like this was Jason Tatum's second Olympic round, right? This was the second time that he could go for a gold medal. And so it also maybe holds a little bit more weight, you know, that you were there before, you've played, you've won. And then this time around, we don't see you, especially after you just won a championship where you should be at the best of your game now. I'm taking it personal. I think he is, too.
I think it makes for great drama. Like, I think that is the thing that
we love drama.
We do. We do. And some people are better equipped to handle it than others. Let's be perfectly honest here. Some leagues are better equipped at handling drama than others, and we'll get to that or not get to that. But I'll give it to Jason Tatum because he sat up on Media Day and he answered all those questions about not being on the Olympic team. Like, I know people on that Olympic team, on the staff that were around that team, and Jason Tatum was telling me, hey, I'm the best player here. And I'm like, I mean, you were the best player on the best NBA team that won a championship, but you are not the best player on this here team. But you got to have that level of confidence. And it's going to make for an interesting, interesting regular season where champions usually have early malaises. They're usually trying to pace themselves to get through the 82-game marathon and then to prepare themselves for possibly 25 playoff games. Now you're going to have a little bit more natural motivation to compete on a nightly basis to show not just the Golden State Warriors and Steve Kerr, but the entire world that you are that dude. And it's funny because in part of this survey, of course, there were some obvious things like Victor Wembanyama is going to be selected as like the best international defender or the best, most versatile defender. Stephen Curry's the best shooter and everything else. But it was two things I want to hit on with you, Ice. In light of Jason Tatum, he was selected as the best small forward in the league over LeBron and over Kevin Durant. Now, that could be a function of people viewing LeBron and KD as maybe 3-4s, 4-3s, as opposed to pure small forwards. But if they, in fact, view all three guys playing the same position, I think that's pretty telling.
Yeah, I agree. Again, this is the GMs, right? So we have to keep in mind like who these votes are coming from. But again, like being in the mindset of a player, you try not to fall into, you know, preseason picks or preseason rankings. Like I did A10 Media Day the other day and, you know, there's a team that's ranked number 9, but yet last year they were 8 and then they ended up winning the whole thing. Like these preseason things, what do they mean? Who really knows? But I think the acknowledgement for Jason Tatum is huge. I think the acknowledgement from the league and the GMs is huge. But at the same time, I just feel like he needs to show it. You know, it doesn't mean anything unless you take all of this personal and game in and game out. You're showing us that we were wrong, right?
And I don't know who he is, because I saw so many people. I can't believe we're even having this discussion. It's October. We should be talking about other different things related to basketball, but here we are. Like, there were so many people who were up in arms, and I'm like, well, who's Jason Tatum going to take minutes from at this stage? And you said it yourself. There were games where LeBron put the team on his back. There were games that when Kevin Durant came back from his injury where you could see that he was the most vital player on the floor, if not the best player on the floor. And, of course, Stephen Curry, you know, closing down that stadium in the final game in a compelling fashion. Granted, they don't play the same position, but those three producing such compelling moments, and Jason Tatum being in the Christian Laettner, Tyrese Halliburton role of, hey, I'm the clapper. You know what I mean? Hey, sometimes you just got to be the clapper. But yeah, it is going to produce some very interesting theater throughout the regular season. The other thing I wanted to hit on with you, Ice, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander being selected as preseason MVP. Do you think, and granted, it's hard to get in the minds of these GMs if they indeed take this seriously, and I tend to think they do because it looks like they take it seriously and not just handing it off to some minion in the office. Is that a function of, A, we think Oklahoma City is just going to be that good as a regular season team, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is that excellent of a player with the numbers that he's put up, like put up MVP numbers last year, of course, finishing the top three of voting, or is it this... Mm-hmm. We're not sure you want to give Nikola Jokic a fourth MVP when we're not sure how great his team is.
Oh, you know, I'm a believer that it can be a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
Most don't like that answer because, like, oh, you're copping out. You're not picking one or the other, because I just think it could be a little bit of both. One, you know, the way that Shai has played, like you said, over the last 2 years, averaging 30 points per game, all NBA first team selection. You mentioned he had gotten MVP votes. And with what the Thunder return and what they have and what they acquired, yes, they are championship contenders. And so I think it's definitely a bit of the best team and the best player. I also just personally love that it's a guard. Anytime these awards go to guards, I'm always like, thank you. Thank you so much. We do so much work and we just talk about post players all day. Sorry, that was just my personal rant.
No,
but anyway.
No. You're letting your guard flag fly. You know what I mean? Like, I totally get that, right? Right?
NBA and WNBA, it's all about the post players. All the post players get all these awards. So one, I'm just happy that SGA is there, that they're, you know, giving this notoriety to him. I do think on the other side, though, a fourth MVP for Jokic, that is high praise. I mean, you can tell us some of the players who have gotten four, who have gotten three. That list is some of the best players we have ever seen play the game. Very, very high praise if they were to do that. And so I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, look, I'm going to run down the names
for
people who, like, Jokic is already in rarefied air. And if I'm just going post-merger, this is where Vinny goes full nerd sometimes. Post-merger, and the media started voting for MVP, I believe, in 1981. So the players that I'm going to name to you have won three MVPs in the last 44, 45 years, if my memory serves. And John, you can even pipe in and correct me if you wind up looking this up. But here's who I think are the names of the players who've won three, right? Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, they both won three. Michael Jordan won five. LeBron has won four. Jokic has won three. We're not talking about Tim Duncan, who only won two. We're talking about Shaq, who only won one. Kobe, who only won one. Steph Curry has won two. Kevin Durant has won one. I don't think there is another player. I think Kareem won most of his in the 70s before the media started voting. I think Moses Malone won back-to-back in 82 and 83, if memory serves. But you're talking about a very rarefied era of guys who've even won three, let alone going into, like I said, Michael, who's won five, LeBron, who's won four. And those guys have multiple NBA championships to their name. I tend to think, it's less an indictment of how valuable Jokic is and how great Jokic is, because he's probably still the best player on earth, right? I don't think anybody's going to look at Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and say he's the best player on earth. But I do think from the standpoint of, A, how the media votes and the tone of how the media votes. And we're looking at it and we're saying, is Denver still a championship team? Mm. We saw them go out in the second round at the crib in a game seven to the Pups, to the Minnesota Timber Pups, a team that was, let's be honest, they were built to beat them, right? when you go get Rudy Gobert and you pair him with Karl Towns and you get all those long, rangy wings, that's what you're saying. You're saying we're going after you guys. And plus, championship fatigue, those guys were tired. Jamal Murray went out and said it. Hey, man, it's a lot harder being the hunted than it is being the hunters. Like, they didn't have the emotional and physical stamina to get there. And plus, you don't know if teams are going to repeat. You don't know if teams are going to show back up anymore. And you're not sure if the media is going to give Nikola Jokic, for all of his statistical glory, a fourth MVP, because you're not sure how good or great the Nuggets will be. And that's an interesting place for that franchise with the best player on earth to be.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Honestly, that an interesting place for that franchise to be.
Yeah, it's interesting. The couple little news and notes just to hit on. Dante Exum, he's going to miss 3 months after undergoing right wrist surgery. That makes the Spencer Dinwiddie acquisition that much more important as somebody who can play secondary ball handler next to Kyrie and, of course, next to Luka Doncic, someone who can also set up Klay Thompson. They got a lot of guards over there who are going to need shots. Like, Dallas is a guard's dream. You're talking about guards, ice. If you're a guard, if you're one of those teams, if you're one of those guys on that team, rather, you're looking around and you're saying, okay, Klay's going to get open shots. Kyrie's going to get his. Luka's going to get his. I wonder how much of a formula that's going to be, just dovetailing it off of Dante Exum. I wonder how much of a formula that is when you have so much ball dominance on the perimeter.
That's interesting, because it took some time for Luka and Kai to figure it out, you know? And so then you add Klay, which we know Klay doesn't need to be on the ball. He doesn't need even to dribble the ball. He needs to be off the ball, spacing the floor. And so I think with his addition and the way that Luka and Kai were able to work together towards the end of last season, which I feel like they were playing their best basketball, I don't necessarily think it might be a huge issue. I think when you have players come off the bench and a couple of subs, yes, you have to maintain that flow. But with those three guys, I think the beauty in getting Klay is that you know it's someone that can score off the ball and that doesn't need to be on the ball, can just make his runs, make his cuts, come off screens tight, and knock down shots.
Yeah, that's the one thing I think that we miss about a guy like Klay. He positions himself perfectly to not only catch it in the pocket, because Klay does not, there's not a whole lot of wasted motion when he does catch it. He catches it at the hip and goes straight up. Like he does. He's not a guy with a low release or a funky release. Like, he almost has a picture perfect release. Like, if you were to teach your kid, you'd probably teach Klay Thompson among the modern NBA players. Like, just the easy, low maintenance, you know, release. Not a lot of hips, not a lot of knees, not a lot of feet. He's just going straight up off the base. So I think he does a good job of getting himself to the crevices, getting himself open when Kyrie and Luka start penetrating. I'm very anxious to see how that works. Last note here, the Magic, of course, they signed their center Wendell Carter Jr. to a $59 million contract extension. He's had some injury issues, but as a whole, I like Orlando as one of these young, energetic teams in the Eastern Conference. I don't think they're going to crack the top four. I think the top four are pretty set with New York, Philly, Boston, and Milwaukee, right? But I do think that the Magic, with their energy and possibly maybe the best defense in the league, because you add KCP to Jonathan Isaac, Wendell Carter Jr., Jalen Suggs, they were fourth in the league last year in terms of efficiency. And then you add in a guy like KCP, who as a vet is going to fill in some of those blanks on the perimeter. They're going to be a team nobody wants to play. Like, they may beat, you may beat them. Right. Like, if you're one of these older teams, if you're a Philly, if you're in New York, if you're a team that doesn't have a lot of depth, you're going to beat them because you're better than them. But they're going to take a chunk out of you on the way out. And I don't think those teams want to play some of these games where it adds up at the end of the season, where you're playing longer than you should. And this team just has so much energy and so much defensive energy where they just don't stop. I like Orlando as a party crasher, especially with Paolo Banchero as a 20-10 guy who's going to expand his game a little bit more this season.
Okay, okay. Do you feel like they have a point guard issue, though?
Yes, a big one. Big one. And I will tell you this. The value of a point guard in today's game, like, we talk about positionless, and pardon my French, that's the dumbest shit I've heard, okay? Like, not because I'm partial to point guards. I am, but that ain't the point here. You need someone with at least a role. You know what I mean? Maybe you don't need a point guard in name only or whatever it is, but you need a facilitator. Like, that's why I never bought the whole positionless thing. You need someone who's a rim protector. You need someone who's an athlete that can play 2, 3, 4. You need shooting, and you need a ball handler who can help facilitate. And I looked at the Phoenix Suns last night in Lansing, of course, playing against the Detroit Pistons, so take that with a grain of salt. But when you move Kevin Durant off the ball and he doesn't have to facilitate, and you move Book off the ball and he doesn't have to facilitate, same for Bradley Beal, and Brad is going to be that third option who can just largely catch and shoot, which I think he's fine with at this stage of his career, that makes the game so much easier when you have a point guard who can set the table. And I'm just looking at Phoenix and like, hey, y'all, if they stay healthy, we might have a real Western Conference party crash. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But I think a point guard just completes teams in ways that we don't see or think about because we're so focused on, like you said, the big guys, the slashers and the wings, that we forget who cooks this stuff. And the point guards are the guys who cook this stuff.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I think about a point guard is just takes off pressure. You know, that is a point guard's job. It literally is just to relieve pressure, whether it's relieving pressure from everyone else having to figure out how to get their own shots, how to create their own shots. It takes off pressure from the coach of having a coach and a leader on the floor that can direct. You talk about these young guys. Young guys also need a leader, right? They need someone who can command them, who can huddle them on the floor, who can tell them what they're doing, and it not have to be the coach all the time. A lot of times with young teams, coaches have to waste timeouts on getting you together and getting on the same page. It's wasting time. And so I think with you, my biggest thing about them not having a point guard is just the leadership component. That is so essential to winning in this league.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see how Orlando handles it. It's going to be very fascinating to see if Phoenix can take a next step in terms of health and in terms of function with Tyus Jones being there. We're going to take a break and we're going to come back with more talk with Ice Young. We're going to talk about the Hall of Fame, and we're going to talk about the WNBA Finals, which are scheduled to kick off tomorrow on this episode of The Good Word. We're back here on The Good Word with Good Will, here with Ice Young. Ice, the W Finals are scheduled to begin tomorrow. If you're listening to this on Wednesday, they're scheduled to begin Thursday. The Lynx, The Liberty, I think this is like, what is it, that sixth time in the finals, going dating back to when Teresa Weatherspoon was going against the Houston Comets back in the day. She had that half-court banker in Houston that forced the game three. They didn't win the game, but it was a memorable moment back then. They have not been able to cross the threshold. They look like the favorite in this series, unless I'm seeing something wrong. I saw that they took out the two-time champs. And even though the two-time champs were not their full form in terms of how they've looked dominantly over the past couple of years, they still took them out. So does that make them the favorite, or do you see Minnesota being the favorite in this series?
Oh, man, I think that is a loaded question. I will say that the Liberty are the favorite because, one, they've won the most amount of games. They have the number one overall seed. They're a super team. We talked about teams that were created to beat other teams. The Liberty literally put this roster this year together in order to beat the Aces. And they did that. The difference in them was they just added length and size. They had a point guard in Courtney Vandersloot, which is one of the best passers we've ever seen. But she is now coming off the bench for this team. They've added a German rookie, 6'4", Leoni Fibish, who can knock down shots from the outside. But she's 6'4", along with Jonquel Jones, that's 6'6". And then Stewie, right, who's 6'3", 6'4". They just have a ton of length. And so that is how they're being the most disruptive right now with their defense. And I feel like that's why they are the favorite, also because of the play of Sabrina Ionescu. I love when we see young players get better year after year, but especially when they take their game up in the playoffs. You can tell that she is tired of losing in the playoffs. You're correct. This is the sixth time that the New York Liberty have gotten to the finals. Ionescu is tired of losing. She's playing like she's pissed off a little bit about it, and she's been playing exceptional basketball in the playoffs. So I would say that they're the favorite from a record standpoint. But if you've been watching and you've kept your eye on the Minnesota Lynx all season, I think some of us can safely say that we would not be surprised at all if the Minnesota Lynx win this championship. Cheryl Reeve, you know, coach of the year, She has won 4 championships with the Lynx. She understands how to get it done. The 4 that she won, that legacy was under Maya Moore. Mm-hmm, we know how much Maya Moore has meant to this game and what she did there. And then I think there's an opportunity now for Nafisa Collier, another UConn stud, to create her own legacy. What makes the Minnesota Lynx so dangerous, honestly, is just their identity. Like, Vinny, like, their identity is this 3-and-D. They play defense like no other. They're in the gaps. They rotate. Sometimes they're over-rotating. They are so expecting to help each other and anticipating that they're over-rotate. But if you're not looking for the ball to hop from one to another, they force you to turn the ball over. And then offensively, like, it's just beautiful basketball. I'm not sure. I have to actually seriously sit and think about what team I've enjoyed watching basketball, like, more than the Minnesota Lynx over the last year. And I mean all of the teams, college, WNBA, NBA, like their style, Olympics, their style of basketball is just beautiful. It's effortless. They share it. They play with pace. Their 5 players knock down 3s. They also rebound. So I feel like my expectation, my prediction is that the Lynx win it in 5.
Whoa, you're saying that the Liberty will continue to be bridesmaids here, that this is not the year that, with all the star power that they have, with all the experience that they've had, with the way that they've been built. Like, I didn't see game 5 last night because I was in Lansing. I couldn't be in 2 places at once. But you're saying that the Lynx, despite having gone the full way with that series, and you're saying the Liberty, despite them taking out the champs, and I think taking out the champs pretty decisively, you're saying that doesn't hold as much weight. You're saying that the Lynx are going to... No. Look, don't back down from it. This is
I'm not going to... I'm going to give you some stats to back it up.
Okay, come on with
it. The Lynx during the season went 3-1 against the Liberty. If there was a team that the Liberty struggled to beat, it was the Minnesota Lynx. I will say that because of their matchups, right? Matchups. You have Jonquel Jones inside. You need a tough post player who's big, who can stretch the floor. Alanna Smith is matched up with her. Brianna Stewart, one of the best 3-4s in the game. She's fluid. She can play the mid post or in the 3. You have Nafisa Collier, who was playing out of her mind. Right now, Nafisa Collier is playing as the best women's basketball player on the planet while Asia Wilson was in the playoffs. Like, Fee has just taken it to another level. And then you talk about the point guard matchups. I don't think anyone expected Courtney Williams for the Minnesota Lynx to be playing the point guard position at this high of a level at this point in her career. This is her first time in her career being the point guard for a team under Cheryl Reeve, which is already a tall task to do, but has really successfully done it. And so I just feel like they have all the pieces, and they also have bench contributions, very good bench contributions the Lynx have, and they have experience there. But again, I just think if you've been following along, it just wouldn't be surprising. Like, Cheryl Reeve knows how to get her teams to peak at the right time. Nafisa Collier is playing the best basketball at the right time, and company. They just look like they're ready to go. I think the only thing that they have to get over the hump with is just being tired. They play 5 games versus Connecticut, where the Liberty very smartly took care of their series early, so they were able to get more rest. And so the Lynx, having won yesterday, today is the off day, and tomorrow you're in New York and you're trying to win. But you've got 5 games to do it.
You got 5 games to do it, but like you said, fatigue is a huge thing. Like, before we even close the book on this, and I know you're giving the Lynx a lot of love, how the Liberty took care of business against the Aces, it doesn't sound like that you are surprised that that happened. You're not surprised that this is the finals matchup. But how impressed with the Liberty are you just in terms of them handling their business against the Aces? They handled everything Asia Wilson had to give. I know they had some underwhelming performances around her, but I felt like that was a function of the defensive pressure that the Liberty were putting on them, that basically you just left Asia out there by herself.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the defense for the Liberty, the length that they've added, that has been the difference between teams last year and this year. To me, that's the difference in their team. Yes, players have gotten better. They're scoring. They're sharing the wealth. But their defense and the length that they have defensively is what allowed them to get past the Aces. And it was an Aces team, like you mentioned, that hasn't looked the same all year, right? They haven't looked like the back-to-back champs all year. But yes, you still beat the Aces, which is tough. You still took down Asia Wilson. What I love right now about New York and what they're doing offensively is Sabrina Ionescu's pick and roll game. I just think she continued to dissect the Aces possession after possession after possession in the pick and roll game. whether it's with Stewie, whether it's with Jonquel Jones, even if it's off handoff and guard action, like when you can just get her moving freely, she is so dangerous. And because of the way in which she shoots the three, right, that she doesn't need much time to get it off. But to me, Sabrina Ionescu has been the difference offensively. Obviously, Breanna Stewart is terrific. She's going for her third championship and possibly a third finals MVP. It is definitely possible that Stewie could also win that if New York does. But to me, I've been really impressed with what Sabrina has been able to do. And I think if they're going to beat the Lynx, it's going to have to be on the defensive end. They're going to have a New York state of mind on the defensive side of the basketball, that they are going to guard the three and to make it physical as heck. There is no way that New York can win if they're not physical on the defensive side of the basketball, because I think that the Minnesota Lynx already bring it. They're already ready to bring it.
All that stuff that you just said, giving all those flowers to New York Liberty, and you are selecting the Minnesota Lynx to win. I just wanted that to be the last word. I just wanted you to get all the praise out just so you could say, yeah, all that's well and good, but y'all ain't winning this series. That's cute. I like that. That is Ice Young, ladies and gentlemen. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the Hall of Fame. This is a heavy class, a couple of guys that you may be surprised are going in. We're going to talk a little bit about that as we pay some bills here on this episode of The Good Word. Welcome back to The Good Word. Thanks, Isis, for joining us, as she's going to do every Wednesday. But here we're going to talk about the Hall of Fame, which will be this weekend. A great friend of mine, J.A. Adande, will be going in, getting the Kurt Gowdy Award. So I'll be going there to see him, just to support. He's been a great friend of me throughout the year, so it's always good. Mark Spears, last year, went to see him. That was my first time at the Hall of Fame. And there is a star-studded class going this year to some degree. I'm going to read off some of the names for you. Vince Carter is going in. Michael Cooper, Chauncey Billups, and Walter Davis, the late Walter Davis. Now, it's a couple of names here that piqued me just a little bit. Now, if you only remember Vince Carter as half man, half amazing throughout the start of his career and then the end of his career where he was the traveling vet, right? There is a big piece in there that is missing. And I think just from the standpoint of not necessarily longevity, but there was a decade of excellence there, even throughout some of the things that were a little bit on the confusing side, or you didn't feel like he, you know, fulfilled all of his potential. I think you guys need to know this, right? Basketball Reference has his probability at 94.5%. Not that you go by exactly what that says, because it can be a very flawed statistic, but that number is higher than Kawhi Leonard, Tony Parker, and James Worthy. Now, we know Kawhi Leonard is getting in regardless of how short that highlight film is, right? That highlight film is not going to be long for Kawhi Leonard when he gets in. He's not going to play a whole lot of games, I don't think, for the rest of his career. I'd be surprised if he played more than 50 in any season for the rest of his career, given how his body worked. But he's got two finals MVPs. That's going to put him in there. Tony Parker, from an international standpoint, he's going to get in there. James Worthy, as a finals MVP in the collegiate career that he had in North Carolina, got in and nobody really quibbled on it. And he was a top 50 player. Nobody really quibbled on it. But if you did a deeper dive, you'd probably have some questions. I don't have a lot of questions about Vince Carter, because from a 10-year span, that's from 99 when he came in as a rookie during that lockout shortened season to 2009, he was an eight-time All-Star. He averaged 24, 5, and 4 and was really, really efficient. Like in the beginning, when Vince Carter stopped dunking a lot, people were saying, Vince Carter, you're settling for too many threes. Now if Vince Carter entered the league, people would be saying, Vince Carter, you need to take more threes. How this works? You see how this works, y'all? Like the tone and tenor of this changes. Like we talk about Kobe Bryant being like this descendant of Michael Jordan. And whenever you see the highlight videos spliced and everything else, it's like, oh, that move looks just like Michael. You know what you're always watching? You're watching old Mike and young Kobe. You're not watching Furious Styles Michael Jordan. You're not watching the Michael Jordan that that put the ball fake out there and made you fall, dunked on you, and then had Charles Oakley pointing at you. Like, remember that highlight against the Hawks that way back when? That was the type of game that Vince Carter was playing. Like, the way that he moved with the fury, with the violence. Like, Kobe never had that violence. Vince Carter had the violence of Michael Jordan. That's what you're seeing when you see Anthony Edwards play. You don't necessarily see the polish of a late career Michael Jordan or the polish of Kobe Bryant. Kobe Bryant played with polish very early in his career and maintained it throughout. Vince Carter played with fury early on in his career. That's very similar to Michael Jordan, very similar to Anthony Edwards. And I think that's the thing that we're going to go and remember this weekend when we go and see the Vince Carter film. We're going to see more than the dunk contest. Everybody remembers where they were during that 2000 dunk contest in Oakland. Everybody remembers where they were. If you saw it, wherever you were, you remembered it. Because every dunk was like, oh my God, he just did that. How's he top it? Then he did something else. Then he went between the legs, right? Y'all remember all that? Like, even his worst dunk was him standing behind the rim, taking one dribble and doing a full one-arm windmill. And everybody's like, that was still a 50 though, right? Like, it's just amazing. And I think getting into the Hall of Fame gives everybody a chance to fully appreciate the legend that is Vince Carter and be able to appreciate what he was as opposed to what he wasn't when people wanted so much more from him. Speaking of someone wanting much more from him, that's where I go with Chauncey Billups, but in the inverse. Because in the beginning of Chauncey Billups' career, remember, he was traded midway through his rookie season. He was traded from Boston to Toronto because Rick Pitino thought he was getting Tim Duncan. And he wound up with Chauncey Billups and Ron Mercer. And usually guys who get traded midway through their rookie year, that's usually a bad omen. No matter what era of the NBA you're in, unless there's like a Kevin Johnson, Mark Price situation where, you know, someone emerges and somebody got to go. Okay, fine. That sort of thing happens. But Chauncey Billups had such a rough start to his career. You were not sure that he was going to make it to fulfill any level of top five promise, let alone going to Detroit in 2002 after a really good year in Minnesota with Kevin Garnett and under the late Flip Saunders. Like, he started to blossom a little bit. Terrell Brandon was hurt. Chauncey Billups got an opening. But think about that. Chauncey Billups was drafted in 1997, and he didn't start finding his footing till like 2001, 2002. Like, that takes a long time. Like, he's one of those great anomalies in terms of Hall of Fame, not in terms of his pedigree, because he was the Colorado Player of the Year. He had, you know, a top three, top five pick. He didn't come out of nowhere. But usually you give up on guys. And a lot of teams did give up on Chauncey Billups. So when he got to Detroit in 2002, he and Rip Hamilton got there at the same time. They went from being a good team to a really, really good team. And then the next year they won a championship. And Chauncey Billups cemented himself not only as a point guard, because he had trouble manning the position in the beginning. That was the problem that people had with Chauncey, was saying he's got point guard size, but does he have point guard mentality? And then he became sort of the quintessential point guard, the guy that can set the table and then also shoot threes. And at a time where we weren't allowing, the game wasn't allowing for high volume 3-point shooters from the point guard position. So Chauncey getting a 5-time All-Star bid and averaging 17, 6, and 3 on his height, shooting 40% from 3 and 90% from the line, meant that he was really, really reliable. And then that 5-game series against the Lakers in 2004, where you're looking up and you're saying, hey, Chauncey Billups could be the finals MVP. It could be Rip Hamilton. It could be any one of those guys. But Chauncey was the catalyst. Like, we talked about this a little bit of what Isis saying, the point guard being the head of the snake, the catalyst. And you got to see it there, especially for that Piston team that went to 6 straight Eastern Conference finals from 2003 to 2008. They had some great battles with the Dwayne Wade, with the LeBron James, and then later with Kevin Garnett and those Celtics. And then Chauncey went on after being traded for Allen Iverson, taking the Denver Nuggets. Going back home to the Denver Nuggets team that he had actually once played for, taking those Denver Nuggets to the Western Conference Finals in 2009 and getting efficient basketball out of Carmelo Anthony. Now, his basketball reference probability is actually a lot higher than people would think, because you're looking at him, you're thinking Chauncey Billups didn't put up the gaudy stats, but his Hall of Fame probability was 84.4%. That's higher than Tim Hardaway, who just got in, higher than Joe Dumars, who got in reasonably early. Pretty much, that's probably the best comparison in terms of play style and finals MVPs. I think they were both five-time All-Stars. Maybe Dumars was six, if I remember correctly. And Robin, I'm going to do quick math in my head. Dumars was All-Star in 90, 91, 92, 93, 95, and 97. So that's six times. So Joe made the All-Star team one more year. I just did that off the top of the dome. Y'all should appreciate me for that. And Dennis Rodman, who's a one-sided player, but had offensive skill, just didn't display it offensively. And Rodman, of course, was one of the premier defensive players of all time and quite arguably the greatest rebounder that we've seen post-Chamberlain, post-Russell in a semi-modern NBA. That brings us to the questionable part of this Hall of Fame that we got to be honest about. Is Michael Cooper a Hall of Famer? Because my thing on the Hall of Fame, and I got it from one of my mentors, Rob Parker, who's very, very big as a Hall of Fame voter for Major League Baseball. And Rob's thing is, if I have to think about it, the answer is no. If you're not a Hall of Famer the day you retire, then you're not a Hall of Famer. Now, the NBA is a little bit different because you bring so much more into the discussion. You bring more than just your playing days. You bring in what you do in college. You bring in if you're a coach. You bring in if you're a coach at the women's game, which Michael Cooper has done, right? He's a two-time WNBA champion as a coach and a coach of the year in the W. I'm sure that helped. He got his jersey retired by the Lakers, a very discerning franchise when it comes to retiring jerseys. Even though Kobe Bryant has two up there, he probably earned those two jerseys, but that's more symbolic than anything else. But Coop, I think, averaged double figures one time in his career. He wasn't a starter with the Showtime Lakers. He was a five-time NBA champion. He was on all of those Magic Johnson Showtime championship teams. He was an eight-time member of the all-defensive team. His Hall of Fame probability was 0.9%. Once again, it's an imperfect science. But I wonder if a guy like Ben Wallace, when he got in, that opened the door for him. Now, Ben Wallace was a four-time defensive player of the year. He was a starter. He was an all-star. He was an anchor on the interior for one of the best defenses that we've seen over the past 25 years. No matter what you think, that's the role that Ben Wallace played. Michael Cooper was a great role player for the Showtime Lakers. He was there when Norm Nixon was there. Norm Nixon was replaced by Byron Scott. He was there when Bob McAdoo was there and James Worthy and Jamal Wilkes. And, of course, Magic and Kareem as the linchpins. And now you look at that Laker team and you're saying, man, one of the greatest dynasties of all time. And maybe that's some residuals. Maybe that's residuals for playing for the Showtime Lakers at that time when the Lakers meant so much to the NBA. And well, don't forget, he was the 1987 Defensive Player of the Year. And, you know, there's always going to be some great highlights that they're going to play over the weekend. I think there was a time that Larry Bird bumped skinny ass Cooper out of bounds because Coop was all time skinny. You know what I mean? Like he was 3-and-D before we had the term 3-and-D. And I do think that counts for something. And I do think in a way, if we are rewarding guys for being unabashed chuckers on the offensive end, if you average 20 points a game, and you have some level of personal success impacting team success, even if you don't play on the other end of the floor, you're probably going to get a couple All-Star appearances. You're probably going to get in merit Hall of Fame discussions. So why would I then punish a player for playing the other end of the floor primarily? It just gives me a little bit of pause. Because I didn't think when Michael Coop retired, I believe, after the 90 season. So him and Pat Riley left out the door at the same time. Kareem left the year before. He wasn't a part of the 91 team that Magic basically dragged to the NBA Finals and basically were lambs to slaughter by the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls. Maybe arguably the best Bulls team that we've seen was the first one, where Michael was completely maniacal. And Coop, for all of that he could have did, wasn't going to do nothing against that dude. He got out just in time. But I'm not sure. It just makes me feel a little bit of a way. You know, if Michael Cooper gets in, I got questions about Bill Laimbeer. Can Bill Laimbeer get in? I know Lamb is not the most beloved of characters, but Lamb was an All-Star. Lamb was a four-time All-Star, I believe, a rebounding champion. There are some players that you think about that you're like, okay, once one guy gets in, it has to open the door. And if we're going to include WNBA success here, Bill Laimbeer being this championship coach for the Detroit Shock, I think he won three WNBA championships as the head coach and GM of that franchise. That means something. I just wonder. But congrats to Coop and the rest of the class. And there's another guy that I do want to mention because I feel like players of a certain time get lost. Lost to time, lost to eras. And there was a period of time in the NBA where the drugs were a part of the discussion. You couldn't have certain discussions without talking about players having bad habits. And Walter Davis was one of those guys. But even despite that, that shouldn't even be the first line that I mentioned about Walter Davis. I don't want to besmirch this man's memory. He died actually last year at the age of 69. But he was one of those guys you had to see. He's one of those guys that you legit had to see that somebody from a previous generation said, hey, he was that dude. You know what I mean? He was that dude. And believe it or not, he was a six-time All-Star. And he averaged 21-4-3 from 1978 to 1987, right at the heart of his prime. His Hall of Fame probability is 30.9%, which you're thinking, that doesn't mean, that's not a whole lot. But it's right behind Reggie Miller. And we all seem to agree without much dissection that Reggie Miller is a Hall of Fame, stamped Hall of Fame because of what he did against the Knicks, because of how he carried that franchise in Indianapolis. And I completely agree. When you carry a franchise and not like, oh, if you stay, that means you're better. But carrying a franchise, I think, means something in a completely different way, especially if you're able to carry them to some level of relevance and some level of contention. But the numbers say that those two are comparable players. And yet and still, it took Walter Davis all these years to get in. And he won't be able to actually give his speech. He won't be able to actually enjoy his flowers. And I would not be the person to take the flowers from him. He's actually the Suns' all-time leading scorer with over 15,000 points, right under 16,000 points. His number six is retired by the franchise, and that is a very rich franchise of players. Maybe not necessarily in terms of longevity, because Barkley only played there, I believe, 4 years. Kevin Johnson played there. Steve Nash won both of his MVPs there. Jason Kidd had had the stints there that he had, but it wasn't as linear. You know, they've had a lot of great players run through there. The Sean Marions, the Amari Stoudemires, like, they've had great players. Grant Hill played there on the back end of his career. But for Walter Davis to be the number one guy in terms of scoring, that says a lot. And I think guys of a certain era, Michael Ray Richardson, who some people said, man, he was the scariest dude I ever went against. During the time that Magic Johnson was roaming the earth, and people were saying they were more scared of Michael Ray Richardson than they were of Magic Johnson during a certain era, just because of the diverse talents and the way that guys came into the league and they played with a certain level of swag and athleticism. Absolutely. So I just wanted to make note of those guys going in different levels of Hall of Fame, per se. Like, not everybody has to be a slam dunk Michael Jordan Hall of Famer, but I do think that some guys warrant more discussion and where we go from there. But congrats to Michael Cooper. He got his jersey retired. I'm not sure if it was around Christmas. It was sometime during the regular season, because I happened to be in the building when Coop got his jersey retired, and to see all the Showtime Lakers there, it's always a great thing, especially as the Kareems and those guys get older. You got to pay homage to those ball players because they're becoming trading cards as they get older. Like, they're not guaranteed to be around forever. You know, as we've seen when we lost Bill Russell a couple of years ago, and you don't hear that infectious laugh anymore. And you saw that Dikembe Mutombo, you know, although different situation, he passed a couple of weeks ago, right on the morning of media day. So it's going to be a great commemoration of the Hall of Fame this weekend in Hartford, Connecticut, and also in Springfield, Massachusetts. But that, ladies and gentlemen, is all we have for you today. Thanks to Ice Young for being one half of our Wednesday shows this season. Thanks to producer John and the entire team who worked so hard behind the scenes on this show. Don't forget, guys, to subscribe to the Good Word feed, wherever you get your podcasts, rate us and review us and let us know what you think. Since all the feeds are separate, you can still get everything else from the Yahoo Sports NBA feed. And I'll be back next week with two episodes of The Good Word back on our regular schedule. And until then, everybody be safe.